Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Femi Okey today of Al Jazeera English. She is with me from Washington. Welcome, Femi.
Thank you so much. And it's good to be with you all. This is Here and Now. The first Democratic debate wrapped up last night. The 10 candidates on the stage disagreed on plenty of stuff and often sparred with the frontrunner, Joe Biden, including Kamala Harris, who attacked his record on race.
And just minutes from now, Joe Biden is expected to respond to what happened last night at the Rainbow Push Coalition convention in Chicago. Let's bring in NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Jeremy. How's it going?
It's going well. And let's listen to that moment from the debate just to set the stage here. First of all, Kamala Harris, senator from California, challenged Biden on his history with civil rights.
Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America? Then,
no.
Do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Domenico, first of all, give us the facts here, the background. What was the issue with Biden and busing back in the day?
Well, the fact of the matter is it wasn't very popular among white families in the 1970s to have busing. And it sounds different in a 2019 frame, but that's what the politics of it were then. And you had a group of senators who Biden was trying to work with and someone who considered himself a liberal but didn't like where the American view of where busing was and didn't think it really worked all that well. And in fact, they're sort of sticking to that point today with the Biden campaign saying that they don't think it worked very well. Now, there's other statistics out there that do show that it was integral in integrating schools and giving opportunity to African Americans who were in other schools in those cities and towns. But what a lot of white families mention and talk about, and something that's in the background, frankly, of what Donald Trump's campaign was like and about, is this sort of white flight idea. You had a lot of white families that left the cities, moved to suburbs, and all that happened in the 1960s and 70s amid busing. And that was what the issue was. Now, I think that this really indicates how far the Democratic Party has changed in just the last 10 years. I mean, you think about Biden, you know, having called Barack Obama, quote unquote, clean and articulate, and Obama put him on the ticket.
Right.
With the presidency of Donald Trump, you know, Democrats, the Democratic base is not giving much of an inch on any of these issues around racial politics, given what's in the White House.
Domenico, are you expecting some kind of damage control from the Biden campaign today?
It's already underway,
yeah.
Pretty heavily. The spin room last night where we had reporters, Scott Detrow and Mara Liasson were in there, and they were full on trying to explain away, well, you know what the former vice president meant to say was, and what he was trying to say is, and it's out of context for what his policies and message and beliefs are. So, you know, this is part of the issue when you have somebody who's been was in the Senate for 40, almost 50 years, and then has to explain everything that he wound up having to do as society has changed and things that were less acceptable then are more acceptable now and vice versa.
Well, Domenico, why was he unprepared for that? Not that specific thing, but a lot of these candidates last night had pre-rehearsed lines. They had pre-rehearsed, you know, interactions. Kamala Harris had a tweet that went out right after she gave that remark to Biden, talked about busing of her as a little girl, a picture of her
with a little photo of her.
Right,
yeah.
But why wasn't he ready for that?
Well, that's, you know, it's hard to know whether he was ready or not ready. He clearly didn't come across well in that moment and still hasn't quite figured out. You know, this is somebody who's had a lot of experience, right? And if he's up on stage with a lot of other candidates who don't have that much experience, he feels like he's talking to one section of the party, and yet you have the entire field sort of ganging up on him. And it was an odd thing because it was definitely among the debates that I've seen previously of Biden. This was among the worst he's ever been in.
another moment that focused on race. Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, moderator Rachel Maddow asked him about why his city's police force doesn't reflect the black population. And this came after an officer-involved shooting of a black man, Eric Logan, earlier this month. Have a listen.
I couldn't get it done. I'm not allowed to take sides until the investigation comes back. The officer said he was attacked with a knife, but he didn't have his body camera on. It's a mess, and we're hurting. And I could walk you through all of the things that we have done as a community, all of the steps that we took from bias training to de-escalation, but it didn't save the life of Eric Logan.
Domenico?
Well, it's one of those things that supporters of Pete Buttigieg really like about him. I mean, it's a moment that stands apart in politics where you don't have a lot of candidates who, frankly, fall on their sword about a thing or a mistake that they're responsible for. And he did that, right? Now, there's some risk to that, too, because if he goes and does that, he may win some people over, but others may view it as a weakness, especially trying to compete against someone like Donald Trump, who apologizes for nothing.
Domenico, there were other candidates on the stage last night, a lot of them, including Andrew Yang, the former tech entrepreneur, who is now saying that NBC cut off his mic, and that's maybe why he wasn't heard from that much last night. We don't know the answer to that, but who else stood out to you?
Well, obviously Harris had the big moments of the debate, and she kind of reshaped where she is in this competition. And if you look over two nights, you know, Biden and Beto O'Rourke had the worst two nights by far of the candidates and may have really damaged their candidacies. You know, their biggest hope, frankly, has to be that not that many people were tuning in, you know, that they were watching other things and that people will give them a chance. You know, Biden has a deep reservoir of support within the party and good feelings. So you can't completely write him off after one night, but it really raises the stakes for him for the next debate. Elizabeth Warren was very consistent on that first night and is still obviously going to be part of the conversation. I think that this field, clearly made itself into about half a dozen candidates who I think Democratic voters see as a potential nominee.
It almost seemed as if the first debate helped influence the candidates in the second debate about their strategies for how they were going to talk to each other and how they were going to debate.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that some of the campaigns noticed, that if you interrupt, if you interject, you'll be able to get in the pool. Whereas the first night, they were sort of cautious and wondering, you know, where will they go? How will they let us jump in? Will they want us to do so? They decided to focus on themselves and their policies that first night. The second night, totally different story.
Go ahead, Jeremy. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say we're a long way from the caucuses in Iowa, even though it seems like these debates, they matter. But, you know, I remember, Domenico, back in 2008, Barack Obama was not leading in the polls until after he won in Iowa.
Well, Barack Obama was always kind of right there within striking distance, though. It's not like he was, one percenter. You know,
right.
This is not somebody.
But anything can happen now.
You know, anything can happen, but these debates do reshape a lot of what happens, which is, I guess, part of the point of not looking necessarily at those polls and what, the front runner status, this or that, and that necessarily lasts. Things can change, and there are multiple debates between now and the Iowa caucuses.
It's NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks.
You're welcome.
Europe is in the midst of a severe heat wave. Today, France recorded the highest temperature ever, 112 degrees Fahrenheit. I spoke earlier with the BBC's correspondent Gavin Lee in Paris.
Where I am now is one of the most picture postcard landscapes, and underneath the Eiffel Tower, it's called the Trocadero Gardens. Mm-hmm. There are lots of fountains there that are banned from public use, but the gendarmes, the police here, have turned a blind eye. You've got hundreds of people now paddling, arguably the world's best open-air paddling pool right now, as they keep cool. And the government have launched an app as well for people who walk around Paris to find cool spaces, which include things like museums, cemeteries, anywhere under trees. The point is, they're saying people can die in this heat. And as you mentioned a moment ago, just go further south. There are four areas that for the first time have got a weather warning of red alert. The last record was back in 2003, 43.1 degrees, and it's not likely to stop there because the peak temperatures of what's been now a four-day heat wave with these winds from Africa keeping the temperatures high here is likely to peak tonight and break those records again.
And back in 2003, you mentioned the heat wave back then, nearly 15,000 people died in France during that heat wave. What are the concerns right now about people who may not have air conditioning, elderly people who might not be able to handle the heat.
Yeah, well, Agnès Buzyn, who's the health minister for France, has said that already they are having a huge increase in calls to emergency services with people suffering from dehydration, illnesses related to suffering in the heat. There is a hospital, De La Rochelle, in the west of France, where there are such a high number of people who are going with either dehydration or respiratory issues because of their health, that the director has put out an urgent call for any qualified nurse in the whole of France trying to get to the hospital to help them out. And they've got a shortage of beds there too. The migrants, of course, the migrants crisis since 2015 has meant there's been thousands of migrants put up in temporary shelters all around France. They've been deemed simply barely good enough in this heat. And actually, there's a school, a dormitory in this sort of central western France where they've had to basically fill it with migrants and their families to sleep for the next couple of nights. But these temperatures, this heat is due to subside by tomorrow. It'll be similar temperatures across France, but should start to drop from there. And of course, Spain as well, these wildfires still going on in Catalonia region that have been raging now for 2 days.
BBC's Gavin Lee near the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
Today, officials from Britain, France, Germany, China and Russia met with Iranian officials to try yet again to salvage the Iran nuclear deal. The US pulled out of that deal last year and has since ratcheted up sanctions on Iran. Iran wants those sanctions scrapped and has been blamed for attacks on oil tankers and downing an unmanned US drone last week. And yesterday, Iran threatened to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty aimed at stopping the spread of nuclear weapons around the world. Sir Peter Westmacott is a former British ambassador to Washington. He was stationed in Iran as a diplomat. Sir Peter, what do you make of what's been happening over the past couple of weeks?
Well, I've talked to a few Iranian officials privately and one or two other friends in America and elsewhere who talked to them as well. What I think has happened is that I think that the Iranians, who didn't really think there was a real risk of Trump or Bolton or Pompeo and Pence and co. having a war, they began to get nervous that something nasty might happen before the presidential elections. They're also very alarmed by the effect of the sanctions. So I think they've kind of brought forward the moment of crisis. So I wasn't wholly surprised. I thought that attacking empty tankers was quite clever because it gives a message to the Emiratis and the Saudis. If there's going to be a war here, guys, you're going to pay the price too, not just us. But loaded tankers, fires in the Gulf, maybe a step too far. Trump was quite clever in saying maybe this was a mistake and maybe this wasn't really Iranian policy. By his standards, I think this is what I expected too. You create a crisis and then you de-escalate it and claim the credit for making the peace. By his standards, having wound the Iranians up and destroyed the nuclear deal and added sanctions, he's doing exactly what I expected, but being quite moderate by saying, oh, yeah, I'd like to talk. What I think he and his people around him haven't grasped is just how politically difficult it is for the Iranian leadership to sit down if they get nothing in return for beginning the dialogue with the great Satan who's making life so difficult for people. So that's why I say, you know, I don't think it's in anybody's interest for this to go out of control, and I hope that there will be the beginning of some sort of dialogue. But I think that the heart of it is, I think the Iranians have thought again and realize that they can't, for a number of reasons, easily afford to sit back and sit this out.
Negotiations behind the scenes, how do you feel that they might be going?
Well, there's obviously some conversation going on quietly behind the scenes. I don't know exactly how much. The president has said, I'm happy to talk without preconditions. But he is saying Iran has to give up its nuclear program. And he's also saying, meanwhile, here are some more sanctions. So politically, it's very difficult for the Iranian leadership to sit down with the president, even if he is serious, about wanting to have a meeting. It's not that easy for the president because he has spent a lot of time saying the nuclear deal was terrible and Iran is a source of all evil and threatening them with obliteration. But my own sense is that sometime in the next 2 or 3 months, there should be a beginning of a thaw of some kind between Iranians and Americans, because frankly, nobody's going to gain from this kind of ratcheting up of the tension.
Also this week, Sir Peter, the US is trying to get support for an international naval air force in the Persian Gulf to protect oil tankers from some of the attacks that have happened in the last few weeks that have been blamed on Iran. Is this a good idea?
We've been there before. If you remember, when there was a scrap during the Iran-Iran war, when tankers were threatened, America took the initiative in reflagging a lot of oil tankers. I think they became mainly Kuwaiti, and there was a force there to protect them. And that was quite effective. What we wouldn't want, I don't think, is for this to lead to some kind of shooting war, and we wouldn't want to have any more accidental shooting down of an Iranian airliner like we had last time when the USS Vincennes mistakenly shot down an Iran Air Airbus.
You have worked with Iran. You have worked with the US. What do you think it will take to get these two countries to actually work together in a way that is not tense, in a way that we will not see that the situation around Iran is ratcheted up even more?
Well, it's a good question, and it's not going to be easy, because in the case of North Korea, for example, there were a lot of regional powers who really wanted to see the tensions calmed down. When President Trump and Kim Jong-un sat down, you had China, South Korea, Japan, everybody, if you like, wanted things to get better. The problem with Iran is that a lot of America's regional friends, Saudi Arabia, Israel, United Arab Emirates, and so on, wouldn't mind those tensions remaining pretty bad because they're deeply hostile towards Iran and they think Iran is very hostile towards them. And so I think it's not going to be that easy. But as a minimum, I would say there has to be some sign of sanctions relief rather than additional sanctions coming from America to give the Iranians political cover. And I think the Iranians have got to show some indication that they are prepared to be less involved in disruptive behavior in other parts of the region. Each side is going to have to give something, because the present situation, I don't think, is good for anyone. And the president of the United States, despite some of the bombast and some of the threats towards Iran that come from around him, does not seem to be a man who likely wants to start another war in the Middle East.
Sir Peter Westmacott is a former British ambassador to Washington. He was stationed in Iran as a diplomat. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, next Tuesday, there will be a total solar eclipse, but it won't be visible in the U.S., only South America and some regions in the Pacific. Paul Maley will be at sea to watch. He's an astronomer who hosts guided eclipse tours with the Ring of Fire expeditions. I spoke with him just before he departed from Tahiti yesterday.
I have a group of 146 people. We're boarding the Windstar Wind Spirit, and we're headed for an area about 250 kilometers southeast of a small atoll called Ahurai, which is about 5 days' journey from Tahiti by ship.
And you're going to be in the path of totality, right, for the eclipse?
That's our plan.
Okay. And I assume in that part of the world at this time of year, you're not going to have to deal with any possible cloud cover?
Well, you never know about that. This is a tropical area. So, yeah, we'll probably have to deal with seas and cloud cover to some extent. And because there are no reporting stations in that area, we're having to take our chances using weather models and satellite real-time data.
And who are these people that are willing to travel all the way across the globe to see an eclipse?
Many of them are experienced eclipse chasers, but predominantly the majority right now were excited enough after the big eclipse in the United States in August of 2017. So this will be their second eclipse.
And I understand that you have seen a lot more than two eclipses in your life.
Yes, I've been observing eclipses ever since I can remember. This will be my 74th.
And are they different from each other? Do you distinguish?
Oh, yeah, right. Some are partial eclipses where the sun is only partially blocked by the moon's light. Others are total eclipses like we had in the US 2 years ago. And then still others are called annular eclipses when the moon is at its farthest distance from the moon and you see a ring of light around the moon during central eclipse.
What are you expecting with this one?
Well, this one we hope will be completely total. The moon should blot out the sun for approximately 2 minutes and 25 seconds.
How much of a difference does it make to see an eclipse when you're in the middle of the ocean as opposed to on land?
Well, you're dealing with an open sea. You don't have air pollution. You don't have thousands of people around you like we did in the United States in 2017. You have the sky, which is completely open, and it's completely different. You have the wind blowing. The ship is moving. You really see something a little bit different than what you would see on land. But overall, the sun is blotted out. We'll have at least one or two bright planets that will be visible to the naked eye, and perhaps a couple of stars if we're lucky. And at the central time of the eclipse, we may be able to see a ring of light all around the horizon, which indicates the area far off in the distance where the eclipse is not total.
Well, and the eclipses that I can remember in my lifetime, and I think I've only seen two total eclipses of the sun, but I remember that all of the leaves on the trees, the shadows on the ground, you could see the eclipse in the shadows of the leaves, which you obviously won't be able to do on a ship.
No, what you say is exactly correct. During the partial phases of the eclipse leading up to totality, depending on the kind of trees that you're around, those leaves will allow light to fall onto the ground and in the form of solar crescent images. Mm-hmm. So you can see many of those on the ground, but they are not observed at all eclipses because of the types of trees where people are standing.
So how long have you been leading these tours?
Since 1970, actually. That was my first one. I was actually born the day after a total eclipse of the sun, so may have something to do with my interest. I don't know.
Well, and what is it like to be there with people on the ship, probably some of whom have not seen so many total eclipses of the sun in their lives?
Well, we get a lot of interesting reactions. We've had people hyperventilate, where they've had to use a paper bag to try to calm themselves down. We get people who generally, are so emotional that tears come streaming down their faces, and they just have these extremely exotic reactions in the sense that it's life-changing for many of them. We've had people literally become eclipse chasers after their first eclipse. That's how dramatic it can be.
What's your favorite eclipse you've ever seen?
Well, that's hard to say because I've seen so many, but we had one in Turkey in 1999 where the temperature was 110 degrees when we first started out, and the temperature dropped to about 78 during the middle of the eclipse, and we had armored personnel carriers and police surrounding us because of the guerrilla activity in the part of Turkey where we had set up our sites. So overall, it was extremely successful, but a little bit, stressful due to this political tension that was going on in the area, but it was a great time and again a success.
That's Paul Maley, who is an astronomer who is guiding an eclipse tour down into the South Pacific right now to see the eclipse, the total solar eclipse on July the 2nd. Thanks so much and have a great time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And by the way, the next solar eclipse that will be visible in North America will be on June 10th, 2021.
An Alabama woman who is being charged with manslaughter for the death of her fetus is waiting to hear whether her case will be prosecuted. Marche Jones was 5 months pregnant when she got into a fight with another woman, Ebony Jemison, in the parking lot of a Dollar General last December. Jemison, who claimed she feared for her life, shot the pregnant Jones in the stomach, resulting in Jones losing the fetus. For more, let's bring in Mary Scott Hodgin, a reporter at WBHM in Birmingham. She's been following the story as it develops. Mary, welcome. This is quite a complex story because at first it seems as if, well, if a mother was shot, then surely the shooter should be the one who was charged. Why is that not the case?
Right. So this incident happened in December of 2018. And at the time of the incident, one of the police lieutenants on the case said that all the evidence points to the fact that the victim, which is Jones, the pregnant woman, was the aggressor. And so she allegedly instigated this fight. And at that time, the police lieutenant said, the only victim in this case is the unborn child, quote. So from the beginning, you know, they said that Jones instigated this fight and suggested that she may be charged. Well, so this case went before a grand jury. And at that time, the evidence against the shooter, Ebony Jimison, and Marche Jones, all that evidence was presented at the same time. And the grand jury decided that Jimison, the woman who pulled the trigger, was acting in self-defense. So they said, okay, we're not going to indict her on any charges, but instead we're going to indict Jones, the pregnant woman, and said she should face charges because her actions resulted in the death of her fetus.
Is it possible right now to make a connection between what has happened in this situation with Marche Jones being charged for manslaughter for the death of her fetus to the recent laws that Alabama passed banning all abortions in the state?
Well, so officials have said, no, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with Alabama's recently passed anti-abortion law, which has not yet gone into effect, and it's unclear when it may go into effect. But that recent passage of the anti-abortion law certainly has been a part of the conversation and, you know, maybe brought it to a different level. And, you know, it's raised those same questions about, can a woman be criminalized for the outcome of her pregnancy? Mm-hmm. And, you know, since 2006, though, Alabama has had a fetal homicide law on its books, which recognizes a fetus as a victim of a crime. And it's one of 38 states with such laws.
Mary, as you've been reporting this story out in Alabama, what's been the local reaction?
Right. Well, some, you know, groups have come out and said, you know, this is a slippery slope. What's next? Criminalizing a woman for drinking while pregnant, you know, or for not going to prenatal checkups, because Alabama also has on its books a chemical endangerment law, which allows the state to charge a woman for using drugs during a pregnancy. And so, you know, it's just another example of how the state does criminalize women already for the outcomes of their pregnancy. And so that's certainly gotten a lot of conversations stirring here locally, but also nationally from women's rights groups, pro-choice groups, et cetera.
Thank you, Mary Scott Hodgin, reporter for WBHM in Birmingham, for unpacking that story for us. Thanks, Mary.
Yeah, thank you.
And the district attorney, Lenise Washington, has said she's still deciding whether to actually prosecute this case as manslaughter.
Today, the Supreme Court announced that in its next term, it will decide whether the Trump administration can end DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which protects from deportation about 800,000 undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States as children. The Supreme Court wrapped up its term yesterday with two big rulings, one on partisan gerrymandering and one on whether the 2020 census can include a citizenship question. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now for a look at the term and the court's decisions. Hi, Nina.
Hello, Jeremy.
Okay, so the term's done. We got these big decisions yesterday. They saved the big ones for the very end. And you've had now 24 hours to digest them. Yesterday, we were saying they were very complicated. What are your thoughts today?
Well, my first thought, of course, is that the Chief Justice, John Roberts, has been sitting in that center seat since 2005. But we always called it the Kennedy Court because Justice Kennedy so often was the determinative vote in close cases. Now, in some very big cases with Justice Kennedy retired, it's Roberts who's the swing man. Mm-hmm. He's not nearly as centrist as Kennedy was, but he's marching the court pretty determinedly to the right. At the same time, he doesn't want to do it too fast. He really wants the court to not look like a partisan institution.
Okay, well, let's talk then about those two big decisions yesterday. First of all, the decision on gerrymandering, the court said it doesn't want to get involved in how states figure out their congressional districts, how they gerrymander them for partisan purposes.
Yes. Well, in this case, he swung to the right with mm-hmm. the other four conservative justices, where almost all the time they're together more or less. And he wrote the decision for the court's new majority saying, look, politics isn't the business of the federal courts. He didn't defend the awfulness of the two extreme partisan gerrymanders that were before the court, one a Democratic gerrymander in Maryland, the other a Republican gerrymander in North Carolina. He, in fact, pointed out how awful they were, and he said that people who object to that have to go somewhere else than the federal courts, and that there's nothing in the Constitution that says the courts should determine how much partisanship is too much and that there are no standards for that. Now, ironically, he pointed to independent redistricting commissions as a possible remedy. Mm-hmm. Now, I say ironically because just a few years ago, when those commissions were challenged in the Supreme Court, the court, by a 5-4 vote, with Justice Kennedy casting the deciding vote, upheld them. But guess what? John Roberts wrote the dissent for the four dissenters.
Interesting. Yes. So he's changed his position on that one.
Well, we don't even know that. We just know for this day, and maybe for this day only, he's saying go do that.
Right. What about the other case? This was seen as a defeat for the Trump administration. The court said that for now, they can't put a question about citizenship into the census. Now, the president, President Trump, said that he now is looking into delaying the 2020 census because of that decision. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, first of all, if the president were to delay the census, it would be the first time in American history that that happened. Mm-hmm. In this case, Roberts swung the other way, sided with the liberal justices, at least on the bottom line, that the administration basically had lied about its reasons for adding a citizenship question to the census. And there are some people who think the Chief Justice left just a crack of light for the administration to come back and try to get a second bite at the apple and a chance to get his vote sometime and to do it very quickly. Now, all the census experts that I've talked to think that would be disastrous for the census. They're just about out of time. They're worried about people's confidence in the census after all of this. And the administration, after all, asked the Supreme Court to speed up consideration mm-hmm. of this case because the administration said it had to start printing census forms on July 1st. That's rather close. I suppose a further delay is possible, but I still think it looks like a long shot, but I'm not always right.
You know, these two decisions, Nina, really show you, though, how much the court can impact the way that elections work in this country.
Sure, they sure do. The gerrymandering one, the Republicans control far more state legislatures by sort of an accident of fate and effort. They have control of many more than the Democrats, and because they've gotten the green light to continue the most egregiously partisan drawing of district lines for themselves and for Congress, it's sort of the Wild West out there. They could very well entrench themselves for the foreseeable future. But you never know. The worm could turn. I mean, in a real wave election, Democrats might win back a lot of those legislatures and then do it to the Republicans, just what got done to them in those very states. So for those who hate this partisanship, and the polls say that a big majority, it's like 80%, hate partisan gerrymandering, the drive for independent redistricting commissions, which was already gaining traction, could, I suppose, really take off. But it's a lot of work.
Okay, Nina, I want to take you back in time to 1 year ago yesterday. This was President Trump a year ago yesterday reacting to the news that we had just gotten that Justice Kennedy was retiring from the court.
I just want to thank Justice Kennedy for the years of tremendous service. He's a very spectacular man, really a spectacular man.
And what a difference that has already made to have Justice Kennedy's replacement, Brett Kavanaugh, on the court instead of Kennedy, the swing vote. What has Kavanaugh been like as a justice so far?
I'd say it's been a good term for him. You know, he had a very rocky confirmation, as we all know. He's done all the things that a newbie should do. And he looks like he has the respect of his colleagues, like he's working hard and he's churning out products that they respect him for the work he produces, that he has the highest agreement rate with the majority of justices in for all the cases combined. He's gotten some very good assignments from the Chief Justice, who normally gives the opinion writing assignments, and from Justice Ginsburg, too, who usually is the senior justice to make the assignment when Roberts is not in the majority. So they've trusted him to write some difficult cases, And he's done a very workmanlike, creditable job.
What about Trump's other appointee, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who's now been on the court longer, obviously, than Kavanaugh? But is he as far to the right as Alito, as Thomas, people like that at this point?
Yes and no. He's I would say, the most conservative justice other than Thomas on most things. But he's second only, but he's on criminal law issues and Indian rights, on land issues. He gives the liberals the winning vote majority in some of those cases. I'd say all of the Indian cases and some of the criminal cases. The Indian law stuff is really fascinating. He's on track, I would say, to be the most sympathetic to justice to Indian land rights claims of varying shades of anybody, at least in my time covering the court. And I won't tell you how long that is, but it's a long time.
Okay. What about Justice Ginsburg? She had surgery back in December to deal with lung cancer. How's she doing?
Well, she actually looks pretty good, and she remains sharp as a tack. She looks like she's doing something very strategic as well, passing the leadership torch to her wing of the court, to the next generation, Justice Elena Kagan, giving her some important assignments for majority and dissenting opinions. And given the fact that Justice Ginsburg is 86, that's a really smart and generous thing to do.
What are you looking forward to in the next term? We said that the Supreme Court has already decided that it's going to look at the issue of DACA.
It's going to be a hell of a term. Guns, gays, religion, maybe some abortion, and of course, immigrants and the Dreamers. And whether the Trump administration can do all sorts of other things. It's going to be a busy, fun, and disputatious term.
Nina, I just have to ask you one more thing while we have you, which is that you've become a meme on Twitter once again this year because you went up to former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in front of the Supreme Court and put your microphone up to his face with no fear or hesitation. A lot of people were very impressed. Some of the newer Supreme Court reporters might not have been so comfortable doing what you did. All in a day's work for you?
You know, I've been doing it a long time, and if you don't just shove that microphone in their faces, they're not going to talk to you. He was there for the gerrymandering cases.
Right. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thanks as always.
Just call me the Totenator.
The Totenator in the Toten Bunker at NPR. It's here. And
you probably know that kelp is a kind of seaweed that grows quickly in the shallow waters of the ocean. It is thought to have first appeared millions of years ago, but more recently, the algae has been touted as the next big food trend in the US. Alan Yu from WHYY's The Pulse reports on how the seaweed boom is going.
Seaweed farming really picked up steam a few years ago at Thimble Island Ocean Farm off the coast of Connecticut. They grow seaweed and oysters. Senior farmer trainer Ron Goutreau has been tending to this underwater farm from the beginning. On the surface, all you see are buoys and ropes.
This is an obstacle course of ropes and things to get your propeller caught in.
He cranks a handle, lifting a rope out of the water, and a green curtain of kelp hangs down. Farm manager Jill Pagnatero explains it pretty much grows by itself. No fertilizer or human input needed. She says all you need is a boat, 20 acres, and $20,000.
That in itself makes it accessible for people to be able to do. It's much less expensive than trying to start a land farm.
The seaweed takes nutrients like nitrogen compounds from the water, effectively cleaning the ocean. It soaks up carbon dioxide, which slows down climate change. The seaweed is food for humans, home for shrimp and tiny fish, and also supports scallops and oysters.
So that's a bunch of oysters that are harvest size in a bag.
These ocean farms can also absorb some of the energy from storm surges and protect people living along the coast. That'll become more of a problem as sea levels rise. This farm is a floating classroom for farmers who want to get into the seaweed business. Back on land, I catch up with Bren Smith.
The momentum's been unbelievable. Again, we have requests to start farms in every coastal state in North America, 20 countries around the world.
He's one of the founders of this farm and a leading advocate for seaweed farming. Now there are farms in Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, Alaska. Maine harvested a record high of 22 million pounds of seaweed last year, but most of that is not used for human food. It's fed to animals and used to fertilize plants. In the past few years, we heard a lot about seaweed becoming the next big food trend.
Kelp is the new kale.
You know what? Kelp is the new kale.
Make kelp the new kale.
Kelp is the new kale.
Kelp is the new kale.
In fact, growing seaweed has become perhaps too popular.
The idea sort of took off before all the practical challenges can be addressed.
That's Anushka Concepcion, an assistant extension educator with the Connecticut Sea Grant. She works with seafood producers and researchers and answers questions about the latest technology and trends. She says growing seaweed is a great idea, but the problem is we need more people to buy it.
Farmers are finding it difficult now just to get rid of their seaweed. They can't get rid of it.
She says usually the seafood business works like this. Oysters and clams are sold right off a boat to a dealer who sells them to restaurants.
Dealers are not buying seaweed yet because there's no established market on their end.
Kelp can be used as a pasta substitute, sautéed with butter and mushrooms, cooked in soup, or ground into powder to use as seasoning. But it's just not a mainstream food yet. And there's another problem, processing facilities. Here's Bren Smith again.
Kelp, for example, which only has a shelf life of like a half hour, and getting it out of the water and blanched within very quickly to stabilize it, and that's just expensive.
If more farmers grow kelp, they will need big buildings with giant tubs of hot water and freezers to process it and keep it safe to eat. Smith says Connecticut doesn't have those yet, so if a lot more people start growing more seaweed, that's a problem. Maine does have some of that infrastructure built out, just because they have a longer history of harvesting seaweed. Brent Smith acknowledges it's time to deal with growing pains.
In a way, expectations have been set way too high. This is an exciting, scalable, replicable thing that can be a true climate solution, but it's going to be really hard work.
He says we only have 30 years to address the climate crisis, and to make this a reality, we need all hands on deck.
That means mobilizing massive amounts of capital. It means developing new skills underwater. It means, developing a new generation of ocean farming scientists and economists and policymakers.
Smith says quite a lot of farmers have gotten a taste for kelp, but they need chefs and consumers to catch on too. For Here and Now, I'm Alan Yu.
And how are restaurants using seaweed? I hear your thoughts, your cynical thoughts, Jeremy Hobson, so let me tell you.
Okay.
Michelin-starred Lord Stanley in San Francisco, they wrap vegetables in seaweed and they put them on the grill. Is your mouth watering yet?
Mm-hmm.
Chefs at Smith, a Chicago restaurant, have created a sea lettuce cookie, which they serve as an amuse-bouche. And if you want to try serving up seaweed at home, we have recipes for seaweed salad and lobster and kelp tamales at hereandnow.org.
I have to say, Femi, I am a big fan, actually, of seaweed salad. I love a good seaweed salad, and I would try any of those things. But I don't know if I could get into Lord Stanley in San Francisco. I
think they know too much about you. Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Femi Okeh.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.